Iran's court system responds to 2 months of nationwide protests with increasing harshness. We'll talk to VOA's Persian service about the Iranian protesters being charged with serious offenses that carry the death penalty.
The question is whether they are going to execute these verdicts or not. Islamic Republic is not in a position to pay that price. There's a heavy price for that.
Plus, rights group Amnesty International sounds the alarm about Iranian security forces repeatedly using deadly force to kill protesters from Iran's ethnic Baluchi minority.
All this shows that the authorities have even less regards for the right to life of members of Iran's oppressed minorities, including the Baluchi community.
And later in the program, we'll look at how Iraq's new Shiite-led government is handling a complex relationship with Iran, the big neighbor to the east. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. The United States says it is deeply concerned about Iran's mass arrests of anti-government protesters, whom the U.S. says have been subjected to sham trials that have resulted in a first death sentence. The November 14th statement by U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan came one day after an Islamic Revolutionary Court in Tehran handed that death sentence to a protester who was not named. Why the secrecy? I put that question to my VOA Persian colleague Reza Darakhshi, who joined me in our studio.
Well, Michael, judiciary and the Islamic Republic as a whole has never been transparent. They clearly, openly said that, as the members of the parliaments also called for that, so they have to have a very severe response towards these protests and the protesters. And judiciary head Mohseni Ejei also said that the verdicts that are going to be issued at the courts should make them protesters regret, and then should get the lesson to the other protesters. So it should be very severe punishments for all the detainees or the protesters. There are lots of protesters who have been detained. We don't know the exact figure, but some say more than 14,000 people. So out of over 1,200 in just in Tehran who were indicted. So as you said, one of them faced with a death sentence and two other with a long-term prison sentence. So there is a policy to show the protesters that we are serious. You are facing with the serious charges, as you said, muharebeh, waging war against God, corruption of fesad fil as. These are serious charges that could lead to the death sentence.
So are the Iranian people, you know, seeing this process play out, and are they feeling intimidated or scared by it? What's the response from the public?
In my opinion, this time is different. This time, regime is being intimidated, but trying to keep its face and try to intimidate the other side, that are the people, the protesters, the young protesters. So one of the reasons why they are not going to publish the name is we don't know whether the verdict is really has been issued or not. But anyhow, it's not a surprise if we hear that the death sentences for some protesters are issued, even with the names. But the question is whether they are going to execute these verdicts or not. Islamic Republic is not in a position to pay that price. There's a heavy price for that. It's a pressure by the international community.
Now, you've worked as a journalist inside Iran, and you know, you've seen many protest movements come and go over the years. So why do you think this movement has been able to keep going for 2 months in spite of all the pressure, in spite of all the indictments, and the brutal crackdown that we've seen?
This movement, or protest, or riot, or revolution, whatever you call it, is different in many ways. Different from the past cases. At least, I'm not comparing with the 1979 revolution. That was completely different. That was a different story. But the protests that we had, at least during the past 20-some years, protesters are not protesting against the closure of a reformist paper like what we had in 1999. They are not protesting against the election result like what we had in 2009. They're not protesting against the shortage of the water. They're not protesting against the price, gasoline price hike. So they are not the limited number of people in some specific location in the country calling for something specific. This is a nationwide protest. All walks of life. They are all demanding one thing. That is quite simple. They just want a normal life. A life that the other people in the other countries want. If you look at the new generation, these teenagers, what they call the Generation Z, they're more or less similar. They look at the world from the similar point of view. But what they want, what they call for, is quite universal. So they just need a normal life. And the biggest hurdle for them to gain such a life, to have such a life, is Islamic regime. That's the reason why they are hitting the pillars of this regime. They are chanting slogans against the head, that is Ayatollah Khamenei, to the symbols, all symbols of the religious ruling power. I'm sure you heard about that, the knocking off the turbans, the
turban
throwing,
yes.
Yeah, the clerics. So this is a sign to show them that we don't care about the Islamism, we don't care about the Islamic rules, we just want a normal life, like the youth in Asia, in Europe, in America.
Reza Darakhshi, journalist with VOA's Persian service, thank you so much for being with me here on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you very much.
Rights group Amnesty International says Iranian security forces have killed at least 100 protesters, bystanders, and worshippers, 16 of them children, in the southeastern province of Sistan-Baluchistan since September. The province is home to ethnic minority Baluchis who are mostly Sunni Muslim and complain of oppression by Iran's ruling Shiite clerics. Amnesty says it obtained a video from November 4th showing a boy running to safety in the town of Khash as automatic weapon fire is heard. I asked the group's Iran researcher, Raha Bahraini, how the group has worked to verify the killings.
Amnesty International works closely with Baluchi human rights defenders in order to identify eyewitnesses and victims' families that we can interview. We have been able to interview multiple victims' families as well as protesters who told us about how the security forces used lethal force in order to suppress the protests held after Friday prayers in Zahedan and other cities in Sistan and Baluchistan province. We are closely working with one human rights group, Baluchi human rights group called Halvash, in order to identify more victims. In addition to speaking with eyewitnesses, Amnesty International reviews closely the footage that surfaces from inside Iran. For this particular province, there are numerous video clips that shockingly show how security forces stationed on top of state buildings fire live ammunition at protesters. Our weapons expert at Amnesty International analyzes the videos in order to identify the weapons and possibly munitions used. We know that often over the past 6 weeks, security forces have predominantly relied on live ammunition in order to suppress the protests. This is in complete breach of international law that limits the use of lethal force to circumstances where security forces face an imminent risk of serious injury or death. This has not been the case in Sistan and Baluchistan province, and in fact across Iran. Security forces simply use live ammunition in order to disperse primarily an overwhelmingly peaceful protest. Sometimes a minority of protesters throw stones, but that doesn't justify the use of lethal force.
Why do you think Iranian security forces have been using more lethal force in this province than in other places?
The horrific levels of violence unleashed against the population in Sistan and Balochistan province is a reflection of the long-standing discrimination and oppression that members of the Baluchi minority and other oppressed minorities in Iran have faced. For years and decades, the Islamic Republic of Iran has disproportionately used the death penalty against members of the Baluchi minority. In addition, we have documented long-standing patterns of security forces firing live ammunition against Baluchi fuel porters. All this shows that the authorities have even less regard for the right to life of members of Iran's oppressed minorities, including the Baluchi community.
What has been the response of the international community so far to the killings that have happened in that province, and what more would you like to see?
We have seen an outpouring of solidarity and rage across the globe with respect to the bloody crackdown that has been going on in Iran over the past 2 months. However, there are concerns that the level of bloodshed, particularly carried out in Sistan and Balochistan province, demands a stronger response from the international community, considering that this is a very impoverished minority and has long been forgotten by the international community, despite the severe violations and crimes under international law that the members of this minority have faced. Some protesters and local sources have actually told us that they believe the authorities are able to carry out these horrific mass killings in Sistan and Balochistan province because the international community and even some people in Iran from other majority groups do not care as much about the plight of this minority. At the moment, there is widespread solidarity, which is unprecedented compared to several years before. However, this is not enough. It's critical that the international community uses all avenues available in order to compel the Iranian authorities to stop the cycle of bloodshed in Sistan Balochistan province and the rest of Iran, and also to help break the cycle of systemic impunity in Iran, which is the root cause of these successive waves of protest killings in Iran.
Raha Bahraini, human rights lawyer and Iran researcher for Amnesty International in London, thank you very much for joining us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. The U.S.-based Committee to Protect Journalists says Iran has arrested more than 60 journalists since the protests began in mid-September, making Tehran one of the worst jailers of the press in the world. CPJ says about a quarter of those detained were released on bail. I spoke with the group's representative, Sharif Mansour, on Monday and asked what he has learned about the conditions of the jailed journalists.
So those who've been counted, the more than 60, are in addition to at least a dozen of those that we at the committee have documented their arrest before the last wave of anti-government protests started. Some of them have been held in abusive situations. The people that we reported on even more recently, majority of them are women. And many of them are held in even prison, the notorious prison, where they have been tortured. Some have been also reported to been put in solitary confinement, beaten, and many without access to lawyers or families. What's even more concerning is that those who are there could be held without any due process. They can be recharged and held in what we call the revolving door policy, where the government can release them on bail, like we saw some released, but then later get arrested again and face even more the same charges.
Speaking of the female journalists who have been arrested, there are two in particular, Niloufar Hamidi and Elahe Mohammadi, who are facing very serious charges that could carry the death penalty. What is being done inside Iran to try to help them to defend themselves against these very serious charges?
So we saw unprecedented solidarity from Iran, from the journalist community, from the syndicate, public figures, independent and critical leaders within and outside the country speaking up. And in so many ways, because this is not the first time the government uses these charges against journalists, and it brings a lot of bad experiences, some very recent. In 2018 and 2019, when the government saw a nationwide anti-government protest, similar to what we saw in terms of the response with the government shutting down internet. And during that time, the government have extradited and executed Rohalla Zam, one of the journalists, bloggers who've been reporting on the protests under the same charges Niloufar's and others are facing today. And these are charges like seditions or fighting against God or any other kind of espionage charges that some are being even forced to confess to on TV before they are executed. So we're hoping that these journalists will not be facing those same treatment or charges, and that we're hoping that the UN, at the meet tomorrow in the UN Human Rights Council, that they will produce accountability mechanisms that will stop the Iranian government from leveling those charges or acting on it before it's too late.
What do you think are the prospects that you'll get a UN action that is strong enough to pressure the Iranian authorities to drop these charges and to release the journalists?
Alone, the UN cannot do it. And in many ways, the fact that we're talking about the UN is that local and regional and international accountability mechanisms have already been failed. We are hoping that this, in addition to other moves, including sanctions by Western countries and also pressure from allies, can persuade the Iranian government not to pursue this course of action.
Sharif Mansour, Middle East and North Africa Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists, speaking to us here in Washington, D.C. Thank you very much for being with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you for having me.
Iran's western neighbor Iraq formed a new government last month, led by the Coordination Framework, a faction of Iraq's majority Shiites in alliance with minority Kurds and Sunni Arabs. The development came 1 year after a parliamentary election in which another Iraqi Shiite faction loyal to cleric Muqtada al-Sadr won the most seats, but was unable to secure a majority and withdrew its lawmakers. Sarhang Hamasaid is a Middle East analyst at the U.S. Institute of Peace. I asked him while he was visiting Iraqi Kurdistan how the new Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammad Shia al-Sudani is handling relations with Iran.
So the new government, the new prime minister, has spoken in the direction of Iraq wanting to uphold its sovereignty, forming normal relations with its neighbors and with the international community. So based on interests, mutual respect, and advancing what both sides care about. So these are the foundations. And this current government is seen as part of a product of a coalition and a process that they believe Iran supported. So there is a kind of this perception, this view looming large over this government. However, in the past few weeks, the prime minister has been taking steps, providing assurances in direct meetings with the U.S. ambassador, European ambassadors, other ambassadors, and with Iraqi leaders, trying to project that he is for Iraq's sovereignty and he is going to balance the relationships. He cares about positive relationship with Iraq's neighbors and the international community. Obviously, other prime ministers before him have signaled these matters. It will come down to the next months and the coming period to see if his coalition will support that or internal pressure will grow where his agenda will be weakened. So that's something to keep an eye on.
Well, you mentioned that Prime Minister Sudani had met with representatives of the U.S. What do you think of the Biden administration's reaction to the formation of this government? Is there a sense that the U.S. is concerned about a close relationship that Sudani may have with Iran?
The U.S. is seen as has welcomed, and it's actually welcomed and congratulated the formation of the government because it broke a stalemate that lasted a year where it was affecting that practical matters of Iraq where a national budget was not passed and political instability threatened violence. So the U.S. definitely welcomed the formation of the government and that this stalemate has been broken. And so far, they see common interests in the areas that the prime minister also said that he cares about, sovereignty, passing of the budget, reining in the armed groups that the U.S. and the Iraqis want to bring under control, reforms, and tackling climate change. So these are key issues that the U.S. cares about. We are in the early stages of this government. We will have to see in the future, if in practical terms, both countries will manage to be able to have a collaborative relationship. And so far, both sides are stressing the strategic framework agreement that both countries have together as being the document that governs that relationship.
Well, the U.S. did welcome Sudani's commitment to bring weapons under the control of the official institutions, but how realistic do you think it is for this new government to exert, significant control over militia groups that are long backed by Iran?
It will be definitely a real challenge for Prime Minister Sudani and his government to bring armed groups under its control because they are powerful. They have access to different elements of the government through legislation, through access to the budget, through arms and being on the ground. It will be extremely difficult. He will try. His success will depend on the backing of the different political parties that support his government. If they stand behind him, he will have a higher chance. But without that political cover, his predecessors were not able to do that, and he won't be able to do that as well. It's a test for him and for also these groups if they can learn from the mistakes of the past that brought violence to Iraq and instability, if they can turn the page and start a new chapter. It's going to be very difficult.
Well, what do you think Iran is going to do as this new government starts to get to work? Do you anticipate any instructions coming from the Iranian government to those militias on how they might develop a relationship with this new government?
So there are different factors that affect how things will play out. Obviously, there is the Iran nuclear deal and what happens there. Positive progress there may have positive dividends for how Iran leverages its influence in Iraq. Negative developments there may have also the negative implications for Iraq. Second, the economic situation inside Iran is a factor. Iran needs Iraq because it's a kind of a source for economic relief because Iran is under sanctions. If the development in Iraq goes in a way that will undermine Iran's economic security interests, then the Iran's allies in Iraq could be leveraged to be used to open those channels and create instability. But as long as its interests are preserved in ways that do not require confrontation, those groups may not be used. So it really depends on variables and how things play out.
Well, Sarhang Hamasai, Director of Middle East Programs at the United States Institute of Peace, speaking to us from Erbil in the Iraqi Kurdistan region. Thank you so much for joining us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for having me.
That's it for today's program. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another Flashpoint Iran.